The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 23 from Wu Men's Gateless Barrier. Huineng, neither good nor evil. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, as far, the head monk translated here, as far as Taoyu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Besides these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practice at Wang Mei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Wang Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." Wu Men's verse. It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. So here we are on day whatever. in this timeless place together. The ship of compassion, the ship of fools, wandering aimlessly with no idea where we're going. Each of us in our own way undoubtedly carving out all kinds of interesting agendas and watching them dissolve like flowers of air, largely due to forgetfulness. Here we are watching things arise, watching dharmas arise. Each one offering us its teaching, and watching them vanish. And still something remains. Something quite unknowable. We have all these words and letters pointing the way for us. Pointing the way toward our true nature, which is no nature at all. And the mind engages and says, "What?" And there it is. Exactly. What is this "don't think good and evil"? the mind arises, but there's good and there's evil and there's... Exactly. Flowers of air. The monk, quite certain he knew what he needed, heading out on his way to collect the bowl and robe. Quite certain he was right. There is no way that Hui Neng could be right. And you know what? When I meet that guy, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. I am going to get that frickin' bowl. Bring it back. I am right. And we've all been there, right? Every one of us. Here we have this remarkable opportunity to just watch that arise. Like a speck of dust. Just watch it arise. Who owns this weather? Who owns that speck of dust? Now, there's not always a choice, right? Sometimes we just, like riding the horse, we just hop on. We hop on the speck of dust. Sail around the room for a while. Get carried along in our delusions, in our certainty, in our fantasies. Yes, that too. That too, the Dharma manifesting as riding along. Nothing excluded. Hui Neng, in the Platform Sutra, talks about watching thoughts arise without attaching. But he's very careful to caution against a common practice, which is a kind of repression. I shouldn't be thinking anything at all. Just be, just be. And then we scold ourselves, and we come to hate ourselves for everything that arises, as if it were a flaw. A very painful, painful practice. I release you. Not necessary. Specks of dust come, and they go. So what is this not attaching to a speck of dust? What is this not attaching to our thoughts and ideas? Well, in my experience, even not attaching is something I cannot do. I am a failure because my ideas arise and I become quite attached to them. But you know what else? I'm a double failure because I can't hold on to them either. Oh, I'll work at it. I'll work at holding on to something for as long as I can. But eventually, time breaks me, and off it goes. This is the nature of life, of reality, emptiness, as form, all things arising and disappearing, and we don't need to do a thing to make that happen. In fact, if I'm trying to make that happen, aren't I attached to the idea that I need to make something happen? Such incredible restfulness to not have to worry about it. There is this intention. that is required, this intention of showing up and bearing witness to whatever content arises, to being honest in our presentation. And that's enough. The Dharma takes care of itself. All these words and letters pointing toward your true nature, which is simply already thus. Who owns the weather? What is your original face? And with that open question, we're going to pass this along to Bob.
I, of course, will answer it for you. You can all go home now. Well, what is your original face? The question is the heart of this koan. The question is exactly the teaching that Monk Ming needed at that moment, breathless after 2 months of running. Who are you? Wei Nung asks him. Who am I? What is this self? That feels so real. And Monk Ming had great satori. That question broke his heart and broke him open, and it was a wonderful, miraculous moment. But perhaps you have sat and asked yourself the question, who am I? And when you can't find that I, perhaps there has been a little moment of anxiety. That sometimes we ask the question and it brings clear seeing and a flood of tears. And sometimes we ask the question and it scares the hell out of us. David Loy is a philosopher and writes about Zen. And he sets out a very interesting idea about this question, who am I? He says that at the deepest level, we all have the sneaking suspicion that there's nobody there. That nobody does own the internal weather. And that this is frightening. And so, mostly, all human beings keep this out of awareness. But that it leaves us with a sense that there's something missing. A sense of lack. Gotta go after the robe and bowl. Gotta write the best poem. Gotta be the best Zen student. Gotta be a different me. Because the me that's here is lacking. And he says that this is one of the things that makes us pursue pieces of cloth and wooden bowls, makes us pursue wealth way beyond taking care of our needs. But wealth for its own sake makes us pursue fame, makes us want as many Instagram likes as we can get, as many friends on Facebook as we can have. Because perhaps this will make us feel more real. Perhaps this will fill the sense of lack. That this sneaking suspicion that there's something missing makes us hungry ghosts. Insatiable, wanting more and more of something, please, to fill a lack that cannot be filled. So what Huineng does in his teaching is he turns and he faces Ming and he asks Ming to face himself. To face the insubstantiality of this thing I call Bob. And that in facing that, it brings fear to be sure and great liberation. When I got my Dharma name from my teachers, you know, they tell you what your Dharma name means. So my name is Tetsu Mu, and they told me that it meant penetrating vision. But then another teacher asked me at one point what my Dharma name was, and I told him Tetsu Mu, and he looked at me puzzled, and he said, "Elegant nothing?" And I began to think, you know, maybe that really is the better name, the more accurate name. That I wear all these robes and I put on these titles to try to be elegant. But who's home? Who's here? And so we shine the light inward. We shine the light and leave that question right where it belongs. And as Mike said, we let thoughts be, we let all these stories arise, we watch ourselves hungry, yearning, and feeling the need for something more. And we let it all be there. Bubbles in a stream, flashes of lightning, arising and passing away. That's what the koan calls to us to do, calls to us over centuries. And when we examine that question, the world opens wide, we open wide, our hearts break, and the opportunity for an aliveness is there in each moment. Who are we? Thank you. So, sit comfortably or uncomfortably if you choose, and let's have our Dharma dialogue. Sean Craig.
Oops. What? Did Jordan have his hand up too?
Oh, okay. So Craig then Jordan.
I think I understand that there's no abiding self. I mean, I see things come and go in me. But somebody's knee is hurting. And yeah. So it has to be mine.
Whose?
Yeah, does it?
Well, maybe not. But, I mean, you can grasp the notion of no self and see evidence of that all the time, and yet every moment I'm reminded of the opposite, that there's somebody there.
Yeah. So you describe this person whose knees hurt. So I get that there's sensation arising, but who is it? Whose sensation is it? And can you actually locate that?
I can't, no. It's just a knee hurting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, Craig, when you said, I understand.
Yes.
Yeah. If you didn't see that, just then he pointed to his head. Some of these concepts we buy into, but we ask that you don't buy into it and just keep questioning. Really? Is it? Huh? Are you kidding me? It's a good, healthy approach. And then at some point, just like these two led you to, wait a minute, there isn't anyone I can find. That's a genuine embodied feeling. And that's where you get to practice.
And Craig, I just want to say that the whole world is saying to you, yes, you're Craig. You know, I'm Bob. I'm okay. You're okay. So the whole world is saying, no, do it the other way. We're really offering something subversive. And you should... Jordan?
I'm nervous. It seems like we carefully construct these identities out of specks of dust, as you describe them, and then we find a robe and we can't pick it up, and all the dust is washed away, and we're relieved that we're still here, that we weren't the dust in the end. But what does that do for anybody but us? How does that help all beings? That makes me feel good, but what does that do for anybody else?
Well, I think that the... So it's not that you're not the dust. So this sense of no self, I think is more properly understood as no abiding self. That we aren't in Zen encouraged to enter some formless realm. That these identities we have are such a gift. And we are encouraged again and again to be ourself in all the dimensions. So to enter, so when you are on kitchen prep, if you tell the Tenzo, I have no self, there's no one to chop the vegetables, she'll get her wooden spoon out and hit you over the head and say, where's your no self now? So it is coming in and going out, and this kind of flexibility where then we are invited to respond to the moment, to be someone, the one who picks the person up who falls, to be the one who chops the vegetables. And as we can enter in, and then when it's not time to chop the vegetables, if you go into the kitchen and start chopping vegetables, she'll hit you over the head again and said, you are not the assistant now. So we have these, we come into the world, we manifest as a vegetable chopper, and then the vegetable chopper dies, and the next one is the one who walks in the line behind Kevin. So it's moment after moment, and it's this kind of responsiveness, this kind of flexibility that allows us to appear in the world as a bodhisattva. Mm. Not the one that we think we should be or was required yesterday, but seeing in this situation what is possible. And sometimes we appear as the one who does nothing, who just witnesses what's here. We aren't the one who fixes. We aren't the one who knows what we should do. We're the one who shows up empty-handed to our life. And when we do that,
then our life and us, the world and us, dance together in some way. And this is the dance of life that liberates us all.
One clarification and one a slightly complementary view of this. The clarification is that Jenny actually does not hit people with spoons. Just, everybody's going to be afraid. But, you know, she'll say no or do this, and you have to bow. This bowing is also part of what David was just pointing to. It's not, oh, yeah, I want to do this now. It's someone else who maybe has a wider view says, do this. And you don't, your little self, we say, sometimes rises up and says, no, I know what I need to do. Yeah, that's part of what Zen practice is about as well. People take roles where they help each other. And that leads to this other complementary view of this no-abiding self, which is that there's no separate self. Right, so we think that we're encased in this bag of the skin bag. Isn't there a pop song, Bag of Bones, by Mitsu, somebody? We think that we're separate. And it turns out that that's the biggest delusion of all. That we are one with everything. The first bodhisattva vow, beings are numberless, I vow to free them, sometimes translated as, all beings, one body, I vow to free it. Right? So it means that we're all interconnected, which is another reason why you want to go in the kitchen if it's your job to chop vegetables, because you'll be letting the whole universe down if you don't do that. And this is also the meaning of being a bodhisattva. So I'm doing this practice here for myself, and we're alone together, and we're not making eye contact and all that stuff. But there's a field of energy that's shared by all of us here, and the teaching is that it reverberates throughout the entire universe. No one is alone. It is impossible. We feel alone, but it is actually a delusion. The air we're breathing has been breathed forever, right? By beings who come and gone. And that's what the Buddha called himself. He didn't call himself the Buddha, the awakened one. Other people called him that. He called himself the one who comes and goes, the Tathagata. So this is what we're not trying to be Tathagatas or Bodhisattvas. We're not trying to realize, like we were just saying with Craig, the through our mind, oh yeah, I get this. Yeah, I'm one with everything. That's a problem if people say that. But, whoa, that starts to occur to us. And then that's why we have ethical precepts. Then everything we do is important. So, yeah. To that too.
I think this actually, like, maybe even quite contradicts what you just said, but I was thinking of something that Sam Harris said, how that, like, the brain projects consciousness that's like, I've got a physical, anatomical body, flesh and blood, and a knee that, yes, indeed, has been hurting most of the last 3 days. Then there's another part of the brain that's locates that pain, owns it, and has stories about it, and the whole experience of having it's mediated through that it's, there is something clearly real that, I guess, like, sore tissue, but everything beyond that has a certain degree of unreality, and based upon whatever this part of the brain or function of the brain is doing, the whole experience of having that bruised tissue modulates greatly or maybe largely dissipates.
Yeah. So I want to just ask a question.
So this is, I could really go on about this. This is cool. But a few moments ago, you were moved by something. Something was happening for you. Which seems to me wasn't about these theories. Something was touching your heart.
No, I mean, it's not an intellectual thing. I mean, I have to use words to describe, and that seemed poignant, but, you know, it's not the first time, but sit for a while, and maybe you get progressively like a sense that this really is like the Matrix. And then you forget
and
you've got to sit more, and you get angry at yourself again, but...
So some felt sense that all this construction isn't real.
Yeah, that just, like, the ability to, just be, like, sitting and have, like, one voice be like, who am I? Another be like, God damn it, you're real, shut up. Another, And then it just, like,
right. Well, I think what you pointed to, David, it's so important, and we're dancing around it. All of us have talked about this "Who am I?" question, which is the topic today. If we drift too far into "I'm no one," "I'm nothing," "I'm one with the universe," all that kind of stuff, and you come into Doksan, we will move you in the direction of hitting you on the head with a spoon. Again, we're not really going to do that. Right? Because you are an embodied human, that is, and you're separate in your bag of skin. And if you forget about that and just go into the emptiness side, that's not useful. But then the other side also, not useful. If you don't realize that you're interconnected, you interbe, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, with every single thing, then you're stuck on this in this form world, which is where liberation will keep being a little bit far away from you. So our guidance here is here's the general teaching for everybody, but everyone here needs a little bit of a nudge in one direction or another, and that's what Bob noticed. Both of these arisings in you, right? And then we want you to keep noticing it too. You don't have to get rid of anything.
Right.
Your wonderful intellect, the capacity to read books and figure things out. You know, the capacity, like when Craig said, I understand this, there's nothing wrong with understanding things.
Right.
It's beautiful, and it's not complete.
It's just the identification.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. 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 Great.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much. Thank you so much.
Say quickly, I'm struck at this moment by how limited words can be and how they can really trap us up, describe emptiness, describe no self. But being in sesshin, I feel like the forms are a better direct expression of that, and I'm grateful to be entering the forms.
Can you say a little more about that? How does it come up for you? Like, what you're encountering the forms and.
Okay, as an example, qin hin, left foot, right foot, up a leg, too close to the person in front of me, etc.
Yeah.
I'm doing it right, I'm doing it wrong, this feels good, this feels bad. And we can do that with everything.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And then sometimes it can fall away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so I've been playing a lot with language recently in a blog that I'm writing. And, man, it's hard. Because the other thing about words, when you speak them, just disappear. So there's an easy way where, if you will, the impermanence of things takes care of itself. Whereas, you know, if you publish something, someone can read it and then go back and quote you, and, you know, and so there's this sense of permanence. It's not real. but it feels like this is there forever. So I've been dancing a lot with language lately, and I found it to be a lovely practice, actually, that for me there's this invitation in language, too. So, like, for example, one of the things I wrote recently about is the word I. And this word is pointing towards something that is unfolding, that is present. And yet we don't really quite know what it is. And so the word, we can use it. And it's important to use it because there is a way that I'm not you. And this is what Melissa's pointing to. We can get lost in just the oneness side. But there are boundaries, true, and they're helpful, and they help us to behave appropriately. And at the same time, the word is quite a mystery. So it points to this, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh's image is this wave on an ocean. I might be thought of as a wave on an ocean. Of course, it's just in more words. But you can look deeply into that wave. Yes, it's a separate wave. It exists separately, and I can talk about it as a separate existence. It's also the ocean manifesting. And so there's a way that we can look into the word I. So for me, rather than, although they are deficient, rather than to point to deficiency of words, for me it's helpful to think of them, each one, as an invitation. That they're pointing to something more than just the word. This is an interesting thought. The thought, you can start to be a hater of words, or even self-hating, because language flows through our minds all the time, and then we hate this part of ourselves. And that's not really the Dharma either.
No. And one teacher said, after you speak about the Dharma, you should wash your mouth out with soap. In the sense that, and this teaching that it is something beyond words and letters. So not that words and letters are bad. Everything, you know, on the tip of each thought, Alan gave such a lovely encouragement talk yesterday afternoon. If you weren't in the Zendo to hear it, you really missed the high point of Sashin. But quoting, on the tip of each thought, a lotus flower blooms, and on each flower, a Buddha. So everything is manifesting it. But if you try to say it's this or that, you are wrong. However eloquent, however deep your understanding, but there is a way we can manifest, and our Zen path is about ritual and practices for this very reason, that bowing is not something we do because someone else just told us we should, but it is some kind of expression. And our walking and the way the rituals we have are ways that human beings for millennia have approached this mystery we call life. We call it the Dharma. We could call it God. We could call it, hey, you, Allah. It doesn't matter. So there is something that cannot be grasped. And this ungraspable trace is expressed in every moment. Each one of us expressing it. And sometimes we know it. Sometimes we, as Melissa was saying, we cut through this delusion of separateness. Or that we are, as Mike said, time breaks us. Right? I will not willingly let go of myself. Myself will not willingly let go of myself, because that's another activity of the self, doing the self. Well, now the self is letting go of the self, and isn't that wonderful? But at some time we get tired enough, or desperate enough, or bored enough, or happy enough, that we forget who we are. We forget our place. We forget who it is that's walking or knee is hurting. And these are the moments all the time. This is not special. This is not something you don't know. This is something that's happening all the time. But sometimes we miss it because we're so wrapped up in something else.
I noticed you were looking at the book.
Wu-Men's
verse.
This is Wu-Men Reinick was just speaking. So listen again to Wu-Men's verse. It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, It is not destroyed.
That's just what I said.
Woman running.
And you know, this is a very subtle thing, right? Yeah. Because we teach through words. We have Doksan with you. We have conversations. We ask you to come in and talk about yourself. saying, wait a minute. But the koan practice, which we're doing, even if you're not a koan practitioner, you are because you're hearing about this koan every single day of the retreat. They provide a vocabulary for talking about this stuff. So the forms provide a physical sense of enacting the practice, and the koans give us language to talk about it. You know, the original face, that's actually a nonsense phrase. But we're starting to get a sense of what it means, which is amazing. You know, that this is, again, you said it was subversive what we're doing. Totally. It's totally subversive. That's right. I have this student, a mindfulness student, years and years ago, just a love of a man, an older man. He had been a student of Yasutani Roshi, actually been his driver. So Yasutani Roshi is my teacher's 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 teacher, something like that. This was this wonderful guy. And he had had a psychotic break at a certain point in his life where he realized that he had no self, but it was not the kind of integrated realization that we're talking about here. Mm. It was like everything dropped away and he had nothing and he lost his life for a while and he was hospitalized. But he pulled himself together and he got married. He had a beautiful garden. And he would send me these postcards every week. The class met once a week, and he would send postcards with coloring all over, like, and words and different colors, and just these wild kind of ramblings. But he had made a vow to never use the word I, me, or mine.
Wow.
And it was really interesting to hear him contribute to discussions. He had found a way to do it. I thought it was extreme, but as I think about him over the years, what a great practice. You know, he was so awake to language, more than anyone I think I've ever met. And as far as I know, he never used I, me, or mine in anything. I'm not recommending anybody do that, because I think there's better things you could do with your time. And you'll find whatever that is. But, you know, imagine. Yeah.
But it begs the question, is he the one out of touch with reality, or is it everybody else?
Well, it's the same. It's what you said to Craig. You know, yeah, you're getting this constant battering of you, separate self.
And if somebody came to me and refused to use I, you, mine, I'd get Jeannie's stick and I'd hit him. Yeah. I said, you know, why so attached?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Oh, you have a stick now, too. Yeah.
Jeannie. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Who is the real Jeannie? Anyway.
We have maybe time for one more.
Did you have a question? I was just, one of the things that you were talking about earlier was reminding me of a saying in science, we were constructing these models where we have experiments that try to elucidate, like, what is actually going on, and then we also say all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yes.
Because there's nothing, any individual mouse is just that mouse, but they can give us a sort of picture of what it is to be a mouse. But it's all wrong if you try to apply it too broadly.
And I think that usefulness is so important. So maybe no right and wrong, but some things are helpful and some things are not, you know, and not to get lost. That, and these models of science, thank you for these models of science that I can take a little pill when I get pneumonia that can help. And so even though the model's wrong, we can use it and hold it lightly.
Mm-hmm.